Shannon asked me this morning what the sermon was about tonight. I said, divorce and remarriage. She looked at me like, boy, that's going to be tough to find songs. And I think he's pulled it off really well. Angry words, nothing ever. And this last song, I hope you will let the words of that song sink into your heart as I try to spend some time with what is continues to be a very challenging passage to think about. So if you'd like to turn over to Matthew 19, I appreciate Mark reading Mark's account. Didn't do that on purpose, Mark. But Matthew 19, and let's use that as our text. Get this on. And that last song is The Law of the Lord. And that means we need to respect and have great reverence for what the Lord has to say in these texts. I'd a lot rather talk about the things that help us have good marriages, strong marriages. I'd rather talk about the things that we can put into place and practice and work at in our marriages to make them what the Lord wants them to be. And even in a world broken by sin, as much as it is, that we can still have joy, blessings. But alas, we sometimes have to deal with the question, what happens when there's divorce? What is the Lord's will concerning that? And I think if we study this text, and I'm going to try to look at some principles in the text, not just the question of who can remarry after divorce, but look at some positive things stated in the text that would help us if we would pay attention to them. And I'm going to try to keep this as simple as possible. Remember years ago I presented a lesson and I brought every book I've got in my library on the subject. I got a book edited by Gary Fisher, about that thick. And I brought them all out and all the material I've got in my files and I set them on there. And, you know, there that stack was, about like that. And then I took all the passages from the New Testament and printed them out, and they were on one sheet of paper, you know, front and back. And I said, here's what the Lord said. Here's what we're trying to figure it out. Here's what we say as we try to figure it out. And that leaves the impression that it is so difficult to figure out that brethren is just so divided over the question that, why even try? One well-known preacher, older 80-year-old gospel preacher that I have a lot of respect for, noted that he had counted about 14 different positions that brethren hold that are very much in opposition with one another, that brethren hold on this subject. I remember years ago, Ken Green presented a lesson, wrote an article in Searching the Scriptures. And he went through a variety of different positions that brethren hold. It's probably back in the 1980s, I guess. And at the end of that, Connie Adams, who was the editor of the magazine at the time, put the comment that he said, you know, I mean, he was the editor, allowed the article to be in there. And at the end of that, he said, lest you think this is so difficult. And then he just simply quoted Matthew 19:9. To try to bring us back to the idea that maybe this isn't as difficult as we have made it, as we try to apply these principles. So I'm going to try to do this simply. I'm going to leave the what if questions to you. Actually, I'm going to leave them to Marlon and Joel. That feels so good to say that. And I know they're just looking at me like, you got to be kidding me. I'll do it with them, but I get to sit down with them and say, here, you figure this out. Oh, me. Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any reason? That's the first question. And here's an example of our master teacher handling a question that is asked in insincerity and handling it with remarkable poise. That gives me the confidence that I can do the same. And certainly I can handle those sincere questions, and I think there are a lot of them when asked about this subject. So, Lord, can I divorce my wife if she can't cook? She quit cooking? Can I divorce my wife if she's put on a little weight? Can I divorce my wife if she simply doesn't look like she looked like when we got married? And let me say something right here. Guys, before you get too critical, make sure you're looking in the same mirror. One of the fun things I've done with Facebook recently is looked at pictures, wedding pictures, and been several of those the last day or two with Mother's Day, at couples that I've only known since they've been in their 70s and 80s. And I look at their wedding pictures, and I hope this is not a carnal statement, but I look at that and go, okay, I get it. I see what, you know, he looked at her and went, okay, yes. And there was something that clicked there, obviously, and that's the way the world is. But we get older. If our marriage is about appearance, we're in trouble. Lord, can I divorce my wife if she develops some health problems that I have to face and deal with? That I hadn't planned on. Can I divorce my wife if she talks to her mom too much? Can I divorce my wife if she's a poor housekeeper? Can I divorce my wife if she spends too much money? If she likes to spend too much time with her girlfriends? If she wants to work outside the home and she doesn't want to work outside the home? And Lord, what if she's no longer faithful to you? What if she just quits? Doesn't want to go to church? Doesn't want to serve you anymore? Can I put her away? And so Jesus answers the question by beginning, by going back to the beginning. Haven't you read? And please understand and appreciate here that Jesus puts his absolute stamp of approval on the first three chapters of the Bible. Enough nonsense in this world of religious people holding the position that the first 11 chapters of Genesis are either mythological at worst or allegorical at best. Excuse me, they are literal accounts of what happened. They are truths. And Jesus said they are. First couple he converted, that he created, Adam, Eve. And I believe that all of us came from them, every one of us. Practical matter, all of us basically go back to Noah now and his family, the whole world, back to that couple. It was God's will, his purpose from the beginning, that one man be married to one woman for life. The simplest sermon on homosexuality. God's purpose in the beginning was what? There's obviously a picture of commitment in these passages, a picture of total commitment. And may I say something? Let's do something positive here. Let's say something positive. When two people who are committed and want to make this work, there are some really, really great things will happen. Some blessings that will take place. Oh, it's awful when one person wants to be committed and the other one doesn't. Committed to the Lord's will, committed to the principles of truth that would make their marriage what it ought to be. But when both are committed, when both have said, this is for life, we're going to make this work. And it sometimes has to be worked at. God said, for this reason, in Genesis 2, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. When God saw Adam, he saw him alone and said, that's not a good thing. And so he created Eve. So the desire for companionship and the desire for intimacy causes a man to leave his parents, be joined to his wife. He turns around and says, goodbye. I love you. I appreciate what you've done. But she's who I want. And he falls in love. And as best as we can, and taught them, and they learn the principles of the Lord, and they go into this with the idea that they want this to work, they want to follow the Lord's will. Please understand that's a good thing. I had a hard time with that. Especially with Amanda. You know, hard for the dad to let her go. It's my little girl. That's too much nostalgia. That's too much looking back. And I had to learn to say, Lee, enjoy the moment. Get in the present. She's not a little girl anymore. Let her go. She loves him. He loves her. This is what God wants. This is what God created them for. May I stop and say something here? Again, to remind you that not everybody wants to be married. That's okay. Maybe very happy. But they desire to be married to each other. It's assumed in the passage that the wife wants to do the same thing. And so parents have to loose the apron strings. And sometimes young people need to be taught, you need to let go of them. And realize that in this relationship now, it's a new relationship, a new family. You make it work. They would be joined, he would be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. I think there's two things take place here. Joined and become one flesh. I am saying that maybe for the first time publicly, at least in my mind, because I think I've combined them, but I think there's a difference. First of all, God joins them together. God joins them, they're bound. They're bound by law. What God has joined together, let not man separate. A bond is created. They're bound by His law, His will, His rule. Romans chapter 7. And so as they are bound to one another, the only, except when we get to verse number 9, we understand that when one spouse dies, the other is no longer bound or joined to that spouse. 1 Corinthians 7:39. Again, Romans 7. Let's look at Romans 7. Let me just take the time to read a couple of things here. I think this would be worth our time. I'm spending, again, most of the time, chapter 19, but let's read these passages. Even though in the passage, he's not talking about marriage, divorce, and remarriage. But he uses that in illustration. For the woman who has a husband is bound to, by the law to her husband as long as he lives. But if the husband dies, she is released from the law of her husband. So then if while her husband lives, she marries another man, she will be called an adulteress. But if her husband dies, she is free from that law, so that she is no adulteress, though she has married another man. It is possible in that passage, if I understand it correctly, for a woman to be married to one person, one man, while still bound to her previous husband, her first husband, the one that God joined her with. But nevertheless, the picture in that passage is God does the joining. And when one spouse dies, the other's no longer bound or joined. They're free at liberty to marry another with perhaps for a Christian, something said about that in 1 Corinthians 7. So first of all, God joins them. It's His will, His law, His teaching. Secondly, they become one flesh. It ought to be clear to us, and I will thank Aud McKee years ago in Anderson, Indiana. You remember certain things. I try to when I hear points preachers have made that have helped me understand the text. That they come together. There is a uniting of the two that that is the picture given to us of the one flesh relationship. And the point Aud made was, he turned to 1 Corinthians 6, and in that particular passage, talking about a man, if he's joined to a harlot, he commits fornication, commits sexual immorality with someone, not his wife. If he does that, here's what he says. Do you not know that he who is joined to a harlot is one body with her? For two, he says, shall become one flesh. It does seem to me, and all suggested, that we need to see the one flesh relationship as primarily those two people having the right, having the privilege of being able to come together. Marriage is honorable in all, and the bed undefiled, the Hebrew writer says, chapter 13, verse number 4. So these things happen back here in Matthew 19. God joins them together. They become one flesh when they enjoy the intimacy of marriage. So then they are no longer two but one flesh. It's a picture of the God given that they have a right to come together. I know there's other things said about it. I'm just trying to use the Bible in 1 Corinthians 6 to explain the phrase. We have applied that to a whole lot of other things, that they become one in their intentions and their thoughts and their goals, their dreams. And while all of that may happen, and sure, that's not the meaning of the phrase. Now, the reason I'm emphasizing that is because to break that covenant, which is the what I believe is the greatest trust any two people can make with each other. And the two people are married and they say, you and me forever until one of us dies. Nobody else. And that you and I have a right to come together, the bed undefiled. And that God views it as ordained by Him, created by Him, to be enjoyed because of Him. But He says, it's serious business to break that vow. And I would argue it is the most serious breaking of any covenant we can ever make with another human being in the minds of God. So marriage is a commitment of two people, a man and a woman, to take care of the needs of the other for life. And again, there are joys and blessings in that kind of relationship. I want our young people to appreciate that, to see that. And many of you have examples in your home of a mom and dad who you just know love each other, are committed to each other. What a blessing. So what was Jesus' answer to the question? Can a man divorce his wife for any reason? And I'm not sure he could have said no any louder. I do not believe the idea of, well, I will divorce them, but I will never remarry, is in this text. The answer to that is no. You cannot divorce them for any reason you choose. Second question. Well, why did Moses command to give a certificate of divorce and to put her away? All right. So we're going to have to take just a moment of time to try to figure out what did Moses say about divorce and remarriage. And I find two basic passages. One of them is in Deuteronomy 22. A man is married. He's no longer happy with his wife. And it may be for this reason when he is fearful that this is the case, that he determines that she was not a virgin when they married. She was guilty of fornication prior to their getting married. And when that is determined to have been so, the woman was taken to the door of her father's house and stoned by the men of the city. There's no divorce in that passage. She was put to death. Listen to me. If the young people just read that passage and went, ooh, wow, that seems to be pretty severe. Why would you care? You don't care because you're going to do what's right. You're going to keep yourself pure. And you'll take your purity to the marriage altar. So you don't have to worry about that passage. Obviously, you don't have to worry about it because we're not under the law. You don't have to worry about it. And there'll be great joy when you decide to wait. True love waits, as someone said. So that's the first thing. Well, that doesn't help us much. But the second one is Deuteronomy 24, in which if a man no longer found some uncleanness, and that's the word used in the New King James, He found some uncleanness in her. And there was some discussion about that. In fact, that's probably the reason for the question in Matthew 19, because apparently there were two schools of thought about what uncleanness was in Deuteronomy 24. And some was just some unpleasantness about her he didn't like anymore. He could put her away. Or some took a more strict view, and that is uncleanness was tied to sexual uncleanness or fornication or immorality, and therefore he could put her away. And so they had that argument among themselves. We didn't start arguing about this for the first time, 2018. And so they looked at that and wrestled with that. But I want you to go back, when you go back and look at that passage on your own, what the passage is saying is, and that this seems to be the passage Jesus is going to refer to here in answering the question. And that is, if you divorce your wife, you give her a bill of divorcement, you send her away, then here's what I'm prohibiting. You can never marry her again. That's an Old Testament command. If she goes and marries another man, and then that man dies, or she's divorced from him, no, you cannot marry her. And it seems to be that's basically what Deuteronomy 24 was doing, is prohibiting that man from marrying her ever again. Jesus appears to be addressing that when he says they were permitted but not commanded to divorce their wife. There was, of course, let me go ahead and read what he says here in Matthew 19. Moses, because of the hardness of your hearts. If Moses wrote it, God gave it to him to write, so it's God, because of the hardness of your hearts, gave you or permitted you to divorce, but it wasn't a commandment to divorce. In Matthew 19, I see a play on words here, a difference. They asked, why did Moses command to give a certificate of divorce? Jesus said, Moses permitted you to do this. He gave you no command to do that. So was Jesus simply explaining the old law in Matthew 19? I don't think so. What he's about to say doesn't match up with the teaching of the Old Testament. Is Matthew a part of the New Testament? Does what Jesus teaches here applicable to us in Christ? Doesn't seem to me, I know Jesus said this. Jesus told the apostles that the Holy Spirit would remind them of the things that he taught them. John 14:26. So even though Jesus is not explaining the law, although he lives under the law before the new covenant was in effect. And by the way, if you want to get real technical about it, Matthew 19 is probably about 2 weeks before the law became in effect. 2 or 3 weeks before Jesus died, put the old law to the cross and was resurrected and became the king of the new covenant. Mediator of the new covenant. Then it was in charge. Then it was in force. That what he did teach, I do believe we can apply and are right to do so in our own times. And Jesus says, I say to you. Let's go back to the beginning, Jesus said. Here's why Moses gave you the permission, and it wasn't for a good cause, because of the hardness of your hearts. And that was directed primarily to the men. But I say to you, whoever divorces his wife, except for sexual immorality, and marries another, commits adultery. And whoever marries her who is divorced commits adultery. Sometimes I like to go back and read Mark's account and just leave the exception out for just a moment and appreciate what he just said. If a man divorces his wife and marries another, he commits adultery. If a woman puts away her husband, she marries somebody else, they commit adultery. No exception clause in Mark's account. For whatever reason. What he says in this text then is, if a man divorces his wife for some cause other than fornication, he cannot marry someone else and be acceptable to God. He marries someone else and they have a sexual union with each other. That's called adultery. Some brethren have written books about, again, about yay thick, trying to convince me that adultery doesn't mean adultery. That's as simple as I can say it. I think most of us understand that adultery involves sexual sin. And try to come up with some other definition of the word. What Jesus is saying here is that when you divorce your wife, you marry someone else, and you come together with them, you become one flesh with them. A, God hasn't joined you together. You have no right to be married to each other. There's no bond. And secondly, when you come together in a one flesh relationship, you are committing adultery. The woman who's been divorced for any reason in that text was not to remarry. The woman who's been divorced for fornication is not free to marry. And the woman who's been divorced for cause not for fornication is not free to marry. And the man who marries her commits adultery with her. Both of them would be guilty when they became one flesh of committing sin. Matthew's account in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus looked at the men and said, guys, let me get something across to you. The man who divorces his wife for any cause besides fornication would be guilty of causing his wife to commit fornication if she remarried. He said, look, listen to me, guys. You put away your wife for any cause and she goes and marries somebody else, I am putting some of that blame directly on you. Before you callously and selfishly just put her away, you bear some responsibility in her decision. Now, she'll be judged by her choice, and if I ever have a chance to study with that woman, and I have, then I have to try to teach them what Jesus is about to say about living a celibate, single life. I don't believe she's free to marry. I know the world didn't pay one whit of attention to anything I'm talking about tonight. Not one whit. And I'm sorry. But I know you will. And you'll apply it. And you'll try to teach others this too. But if the man puts away his wife because she's guilty of fornication, then when he marries another woman, he is not guilty of committing adultery, nor is the woman he marries. And if that's not the case, then the exception clause makes absolutely no sense whatsoever. It means nothing. It's just somebody. We might as well decide that some scribe wrote it in Matthew's account and not in Mark's, just to mess our minds up. A parent to a son. If you leave this house for any reason while we're gone, you will be grounded for a month. Pretty clear. Jack just looked at me, guys, with his eyes about that big around. He said, seriously, you ever told your son that? He's probably thinking, boy, that's pretty tough, Dad. If you leave this house for any reason while we're gone, I will ground you for a month. But if I say this, if you leave this house for any reason while we're gone, except to take your sister to the ER, you will be grounded for a month. Then everybody understands that if he takes his sister to the ER, and hopefully he will, he'd care enough about her to do that, then he will not be grounded for a month. That's just understanding English language. That's just understanding the text. I don't understand brethren who argue that the exception doesn't mean they can remarry. You can put them away for that. Okay, we got Jesus now saying, no, you can't divorce them for any reason. But then we move in a step further and say, yes, you can divorce them if they're guilty of fornication, but you can't remarry. And that's not reading this text accurately in my understanding. If you divorce your wife for sex or immorality and marry someone else, you do not commit adultery. So is that a hard saying? So we would understand that there is one exception. One exception. One reason. One biblical, God-given, Jesus-ordained reason for a spouse to put away their spouse. And that if that spouse is guilty of fornication, they've broken the vow. But Lee, wait a minute. Okay, wait a minute. I just know it gives them the God-given right. There may be other factors that have to be considered, but it gives them the right to do that. Do they have to? No. Is this a hard saying? Is it a narrow view of divorce and remarriage? I want you to listen to what 12 men, apparently this could have been others as well, I guess, but it seemed the implication seems to be the 12. I want you to listen to what 12 men said to what Jesus just said. If such is the case of the man with his wife, it is better not to marry. And all I can tell you is with that attitude, I hope they didn't. One of them already was. I know that. You don't. Peter was. These guys looked at each other and looked at Jesus and said, whoa, wait a minute. And I don't care whether any of us ever understand this subject correctly. Whenever I get to the point where I start trying to loosen the principles, trying to find a way of sitting at the table with someone who's giving me this scenario, and I'm trying so hard, you know. The last thing I want to tell them is, I don't believe you have a right to marry. I need to go back and listen to what these 12 men said to Jesus. And what they said to him was, that's pretty severe. That's pretty strict. And if that's the way it is, then we might be better off not marrying, because you're telling us if we get married and then all these things that make us unhappy and we can't put them away. And Jesus said, that's exactly what I'm telling you. Jesus said, not everybody can accept the saying, but only those to whom it's been given. That sounds like Calvinism to me. Just reading it by itself. It's like, you know, God made it possible for some people to accept what he taught on the subject and others not. I think he goes on and explains it in verse 12. There are eunuchs who were born thus from their mother's womb. Simply put, there may be some folks who are born that without any sexual desires, for whatever reason, don't have any desire to be married. Okay. There are eunuchs who were made eunuchs by men. I'm not going to try, you know, that, you know, you read that and I can imagine people going, how do they do that? Well, accidents, torture. And maybe sometimes somebody just taking somebody in a slave. I don't know what the Ethiopian treasurer in chapter 8 of Acts was in a position of having been bought and told, this is your job, and your job doesn't mean you could get to be married. And so he was under that kind of compulsion of somebody in authority that you just can't do it. You can't marry. So that might be for some. But then he says, there are some eunuchs who've made themselves eunuchs for the kingdom of heaven's sake. There are some folks who've said, okay, I can't marry. And I am going to have to live my life in this present set of circumstances, as I understand Jesus' teaching. I divorced my wife for some cause other than fornication. This is where I am. The woman who was divorced for fornication, this is where she is. The woman who divorced not for fornication, the bond is still there between her, she and her husband. Jesus says, you have to make yourself a eunuch for the kingdom of heaven's sake. And then Jesus said, he who is able to accept it, let him accept it. Who's able? I would suggest to you it'd be okay to translate that. I want to be very careful. But to say who is willing to accept it. And not many people will be. When I get done with this lesson, I'm done. That I feel a couple things, and that is, if I've accomplished, and the parents are going, thank you, Lee, we appreciate this, because you have just scared our kids to death. That's not my goal. But it's serious business. It's a serious business to make a decision to get married. It's for life. And at the end of the lesson, again, as I said before, what if? And there are probably only a couple that I even want to bother with anymore that I even think are relevant in trying to help people weed through. Betch and I sat down with a young woman a while back. And I don't guess I've ever got done with a piece of paper. If you'd like to see it, I'll show it to you sometime. But I ever got done with a piece of paper that just, I had this person married to this person and this person. And I just had arrows and I, Betch and I both just kind of thought, wow. And Betsy and I finally had to tell her. After we looked at all the information she gave us. I said, I don't believe you have a right to be married. She said she was going to go tell her boyfriend that she had no right to be married, so she was going to end that relationship. But anyway, I hate those moments. Hate them. I say I hate them. I love the Lord and I love His Word. And I want people to go to heaven. And I can't imagine how painful and hard that may be to hear those words. But I believe Jesus taught that. And anybody who would ever say, well, I just can't imagine Jesus ever saying that somebody can't marry, has not read this text and understood it in its simplest, in the simplicity in which it's worded, at least to my understanding. Let's sing a song. Be encouraged. Be thankful for God's word. Love His law. And love the good things we can learn from this text. If we can be of any help to anybody in this audience tonight that may not be a Christian, we'd like to be. I love you and care about you, and we want you to follow.